Thank you. Our final oral argument this morning is file number A20-0754, Jameson John Stewart versus John Doe Respondent versus, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Hoda Ahmed Saloub et al. Since the respondent did not file a brief, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument. Counsel, whenever you're ready, just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, and you may begin. You will have 15 minutes for your argument.
May it please the court, my name is Rosalind R. Sullivan, and I, along with my co-counsel, Calandra Revering, represent the appellant, Hoda Saloub. This is an appeal from an order of the district court dated on March 23rd, 2020, in which permanent legal and physical custody of the appellant's cousin was awarded to respondent. The trial court erred in dismissing the appellant's amended third-party petition for custody, as well as failing to dismiss respondent's petition for third-party custody. Appellate court's review of a district court's third-party custody determination is limited to whether the court abused its discretion. A district court abuses its discretion by making findings unsupported by the evidence or by improperly applying the law. This court should remand this matter to the lower court for a full evidentiary hearing on the issues of whether either party has established that other extraordinary circumstances exist under the statute, as well as the determination as to whether a custody determination in favor of either party is in the child's best interest. The appellant is the cousin of the minor child at issue, and on September 1st, 2019, the minor child's mother died tragically in a car accident along with one of her other children. At the time of her death, the minor child resided with her mother and her siblings. However, at the time of the death of her mother, she was visiting the respondent. When upon hearing of the death, the respondent actually brought the minor child to the appellant and her family. Respondent then decided to contact law enforcement, claiming kidnapping, and used the FBI to access the minor child without one shred of evidence that he actually had the legal authority or right to do so. On September 6, 2019, respondent filed an emergency ex parte motion, a petition for third-party custody, and based upon those filings, custody was transferred to respondent. Appellant, along with her cousins, filed a petition for third-party custody of the minor child. However, appellant Saloub is the only party appealing the lower court's decision. The parties also filed cross motions to dismiss the petitions, and a hearing was held on February 5th, 2020. It is our position that the court erred in granting respondents third-party petition and finding that he had met the burden of proof, and that appellant's petition was denied, and the lower court erred in failing to dismiss the respondent's third-party petition, even though the statute required dismissal according to the facts in the case. There are two primary statutes that are relevant to this case, as well as supporting case law. And the first is Minnesota Statute 257C.03, which outlines the standards for filing a petition for third-party custody. And Minnesota Statute 257C.04, which states that if two or more parties are seeking custody of a child, the court must consider and evaluate all relevant factors in determining whether it is in the child's best interest to have custody transferred to either party. 257C.03 subdivision 2 establishes the requisites of a petition for third-party custody. And the statute identifies two categories of individuals who have jurisdiction to petition for custody: a de facto custodian and an interested third party. A person petitioning for custody under the statute must support all allegations required by the subsection, including the jurisdiction allegation, with competent evidence. In this case, neither party was a de facto parent. And so both parties fall under the category of interested third party. The statute outlines what's called endangerment requirements. And so under 257C, to establish that an individual is an interested third party, the individual must show by clear and convincing evidence that one of the endangerment factors exists. They also must show and prove by a preponderance of the evidence that it is in the child's best interest to be in the custody of the third party. And finally, they must show by clear and convincing evidence that granting the petition would not violate section 518.179. There's also in this, this portion that's relevant here is the fact that both petitioners for third party custody focused on the subsection 3, which indicates other extraordinary circumstances. The key facts in this case are that respondent Stewart was not the biological father of the minor child. Even though he was married, he was divorced from the child's mother at the time of her death, never petitioned to adopt the child. The minor child had not lived with the respondent since May of 2013 and only visited the respondent on weekends. When the respondent learned of the child's death, he actually took the child to the appellants and her family members. On February 5th, the court held a hearing where appellant argued through her pleadings with competent evidence that she in fact had substantial contacts and a substantial relationship with the minor child. At that same hearing, the respondent alleged the same facts. But the respondent falsely argued that there was no relationship between the appellant and the minor child at all, despite the fact that he knew where to take the minor child, knew how to contact the appellant, and actually took the minor child to the appellant and her family. He claimed to be the primary caregiver of the minor child from the age of 4 months old. This was a factor that he continued to allege in his affidavit.
Well, Ms. Sullivan, I don't think the district court found that he was a primary caretaker. I think the district court did acknowledge that mother was, but that he did assist in caretaking of the child.
The trial court found in its analysis of the best interest standards that the respondent was the primary caregiver since the age of four.
A primary, not the primary.
Well, and the facts that he alleged, those were factors that he alleged on his own without competent evidence other than his own word. He provided no verification that the child, that he provided care for the child or was a primary caregiver other than his own word.
Why isn't that enough? I mean, under Lewis Miller, that two-step process, don't you just have to make a prima facie case in essence of the substantial relationship between the parties, between the adult and the child?
Well, under Lewis Miller, yes, Your Honor, you are correct that there has to be a showing of a substantial relationship with the child if a third party petitioner is petitioning under the category or the endangerment section of other extraordinary circumstances. And the issue here really revolves around the fact that even if the court found and believed the petitioner, the appellant in this case provided the same allegations about providing care for the child. So here the question is that whether other extraordinary circumstances is whether providing that or proving that you have substantial contacts actually is enough to provide other extraordinary circumstances. And here, I do not believe that the cases, that the facts or the case law indicate that that providing or showing that you have substantial contacts with a child is enough to prove other extraordinary circumstances.
But it's certainly a factor. I mean, the Lewis Miller two case did acknowledge Kai Chin's substantial relationship requirement.
Yes, but it also acknowledges that, or also states that a party, that extraordinary circumstances is not, or sufficient context or substantial context is not a standalone factor, that there have to be other extraordinary circumstances. The court held in Pearson v. Northrop that Tyson does not stand for the proposition that a substantial relationship constitutes extraordinary circumstances alone. The documents that are provided and the proof provided by the respondent indicate that he was a primary caregiver, but he was imprisoned for many months of the child's life, living in another state. And so even if the court does find that there was substantial contact, it's not a competing issue with petitions. In fact, if there are competing petitions, the statutes require that there be a full analysis of what's in the child's best interest. And here the lower court seems to say that because there was substantial contact between this individual, and that's all that it took. And the next step was a transfer of custody. And that cannot be the intention of the statute, that there is no evaluation of what's in the child's best interest.
So how do you think that evaluation needed to be taken place by the district court?
I think that as is clear, that is clear in the Lewis matter, is that it's a two-pronged process. So if the parties prove first by competent evidence that they have standing, that there is substantial contact, that the next stage would be an evidentiary hearing. I do not believe that even in Kyason, that the court intended in the narrowing of its definition to say that any person with substantial contacts, no matter whether the person is fit or whether the person is dangerous, whether the person provided great care, it was not the intent to say that any person with contacts would have standing. That negates the whole point in having a best interest factor and a best interest standard. It contradicts the statute that indicates that you have to have a full evaluation of what's in the child's best interest. That could not be done at that one hearing.
So why wasn't the hearing that the district court held, why wasn't that sufficient?
Because it was only on a hearing on whether there should be a dismissal of the case. There was enough factors provided to the court that actually indicated that it was not in fact in the child's best interest to be placed with the respondent.
Ms. Sullivan, yes. I just have a question, because in the district court's order, as a result of that hearing, I mean, as you know, of course, there are specific findings on best interests.
Yes.
That the court makes. And so I don't know, correct me, I assume there was discussion of best interests of the child. I don't know what the origin of these findings was, but it seemed like there was an effort to address that.
Your Honor, what I see in the court's order is an analysis or an attempt at analyzing the best interest of the child. But all of the evidence was not taken into consideration. None of the documents that show the actual endangerment of the child in the custody of respondent was even addressed. It is as if the court took only the respondent's statement and none of the other information entered into the court record to address the safety of the child. In fact, the court found that the respondent's home was stable and satisfactory, even though we submitted affidavits and supporting documents that showed that there were police raids. Someone once raped at the residence when the child was there, that showed pictures of the house in disarray and marijuana being found in the room that the child was alleged to have resided in. But the court—
So are you saying that you did provide evidence and other documentation to the court, but the court just did not deem those to be something that overcame what Mr. Stewart provided to the court?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
In fact, the court also held that respondent does not have a history of health problems that impact his parenting, when in fact he even alleged that he has a history of post-traumatic stress syndrome from being robbed so many times from the use and possible sale of marijuana. The court also held the petitioner is financially responsible for the minor child when no documentation to the court was provided that he even had a job or any means of caring for the child but financially. So
what would have occurred at a subsequent hearing that did not occur at this hearing that was required by the statute?
There would have been an establishment at a hearing. When we look at this statute, it requires a preponderance of the evidence that is in the child's best interest. And you can only find on a preponderance of the evidence through an evidentiary hearing.
So is your position that the district court erred, one, by making factual findings that are not supported by the record? It's only testimony, there's no documentation, et cetera, and two, the district court erred as a matter of law by not holding an evidentiary hearing where you've got cross-examination and you know, witnesses testifying and credibility determinations made based on that testimony?
Yes, Your Honor. And I say that because look at Minnesota Statute 257C.04. It requires that if there are two or more parties seeking custody of a child, the court must consider and evaluate all relevant factors in determining the best interest of the child. It is clear from the findings, it is clear from the analysis that the court made that it did not do that, that it did not take into consideration the numerous police reports, the numerous issues with drug use, the numerous misstatements of the respondent in his petition. None of those factors were taken into consideration. They were not evaluated. And even if there had been an assessment of those of that evidence at this hearing, then possibly this court could rely on the analysis of the lower court. But it cannot, because that analysis was not made, and it can only be made with an evidentiary hearing.
Thank you, Ms. Sullivan. The matter is submitted. You will have our decision within 90 days.